Hello, and welcome to Sobercast, where we provide AA speaker meetings and workshops in podcast format. We're an ad-free podcast, and if you enjoy listening, please help us be self-supporting by visiting Sobercast.com, look for the donate link, and drop a dollar or two into our virtual basket. We hope you enjoy the podcast. Have a great day.
Hey, fellas, my name is Daryl, and I'm an alcoholic.
Hey, Daryl!
Just let me start out by saying thank God for another day of sobriety. And say that I'm very nervous. There's a lot of people in here. And my sponsor just got here, so I feel a little better. But I do want to thank the group, Fifth Edition Group, for having me. This is a precious moment. It's an honor to be here. I owe this to AA to keep doing what I'm doing. My sobriety date is 2001, March 3rd. I've been, in another month, I have 13 years. One through five, one through six, one through seven was a breeze. I had a desire to stay sober, went to a lot of meetings, worked, got on material things. I'm a very materialistic guy. You know, nice TVs, nice cars, nice this and nice that. You know? And those are the benefits that come with, you know, you when you get sober, you go to work, you know. When I was drunk, I didn't go to work, okay? You know, I did, you know. But it was a coincidence you said your birthday was May 3rd, 1961. Mine is May 3rd, 1966. I'm 47 years old. I think I look pretty good. Can't tell me that. But when I was coming up, some guy said, are you the speaker tonight? I said, man, why is he targeting me? Am I, because I'm black? I said, here we go. And that was one of my issues coming up, you know. I always thought everybody was picking on me, you know, at a very early age. And I come from a dysfunctional family. My dad was a good guy. My mom was a good lady. Unfortunately, she did drugs. And she was a drunk. She was alcoholic. And she left us when I was 11 years old. And I couldn't understand it. It confused me a lot, you know. I remember going to court at a very early age, you know, who do you want to live with? And I was the middle child, and, you know, my sister was the oldest, my little brother. He didn't know too much, you know, we was all like 2 and 3 years apart. But I was the middle one, and I was always indecisive. I didn't care. I wanted, you know, I loved my mom, but it didn't matter to me. My answers were always, I don't care. It doesn't matter. My sister was the oldest, so she always had the control, you know. We watched everything she wanted to watch on TV. That's why I watched soap operas when I was 35 years old, General Hospital, you know. Because she controlled the TV. So we had to watch General Hospital when we got out of school at 3 o'clock, you know. So, you know, but what I did, I had some feelings behind my mom leaving us. And I had some feelings behind her doing drugs and alcohol like she was doing. I had a lot of feelings of abandonment. Not feeling complete when she left. And all I knew after that, she left and my dad raised us. And I remember my aunt and my grandmother and everybody was helping my dad. My dad's mom and his sisters was helping him raise us. And we became real closer to them, which one of his sisters had two older boys and they played basketball. And she had a daughter, and they practically, we stayed with them a lot because my dad worked a lot. He was a good guy. He drank. He drank Pabst Blue Ribbon. And I remember a lot of nights him, you know, crashing on the couch. But I remember him getting up at 7 o'clock in the morning going to work. I remember him consistently. And what he instilled in me was to work. He instilled it. And I still have those work ethics and all that stuff today. He instilled us to go to work and, you know, be independent and make our own money and all that. Which I'm so grateful for that. So, you know, everything, that, you know, because of my addiction when I was out there, when I was drinking and stuff, you know, everything didn't leave me. You know, I came in here with some of those assets, or, you know, some of the stuff that was still instilled in me, and I'm grateful for that. But there was a lot of things that I lost, you know. And I know you guys know what I'm talking about, because we, you know, some of those spiritual principles that we thought we was, you know, I just lost everything, you know. Most of all, I lost myself. And it hurt me. About 25 years later, my mom pops up from California. Her family knew where she was. My grandmother, on her side and all that, they knew where she was, but they never told us. And why she left, I guess she was ashamed of what she had done and how she had turned out or whatever. And she pops up, and she's very ill. She's got Parkinson's. She's got high blood pressure, diabetes, and all this kind of stuff, you know. I wanted to see my mom, though. And I'm going to go back just a little bit, you know. And coming up with my cousins, you know, it was very difficult, you know. I remember us having everything we wanted for Christmas at the age of 11 and 12. And I remember the next couple of years having nothing, almost nothing for Christmas, you know. And I couldn't understand how our lives had turned this, did this 360 turn, you know. And I was just devastated. And we just had to hang in there the best we could. And me and my brother and my sister, we became like this. But note that when I told you that we were with our older cousins, and my older cousins, they played basketball, and they was popular in high school and stuff. So, you know, they took us under their wing, and quite naturally, they was drinking. We was drinking Jägermeister. I was drinking Jägermeister and whatever at 12, 13 years old, you know. And we were smoking pot. So, you know, I was going in seventh grade. I was going to school. I'd smoke me a joint before I get on the bus, you know. Imagine that. Brain cells gone. Ooh, by the time I got to 12, the brain cells gone. So my thing was to be accepted, you know, be accepted wherever I went, you know, because I didn't have that at home. You know, my whole deal was, you know, I need you to like me. I need you to love me, because I didn't have that at home. Nor, as I told you, my dad worked a lot, so I didn't get those. I remember getting those kisses from mommy at home, you know, baby, it's going to be all right, and then it being cut off from dad telling you, boy, you better get out there and cut that grass. Boy, you better go do this. Boy, you better go do that. And everything was just stern then. You know, there was no more mommy's kisses and mommy's love, you know. And I, you know, I guess I feel some kind of way. I guess early on I envied. Friends had told me, well, my mother's doing this for me, and my mother's doing this. I didn't have a mother, you know. And you know, guys, I'm not going to whine on that today. You know, I've done some work. I've done some step work, and, you know, I've got through those issues. But to be honest, a little of that stuff still lingers in me today. Some of those issues still bother me today, and it comes out in other ways. It manifests in other ways, and it comes out. So, you know, through my addiction, you know, I did anything for you to like me, for you to love me. I give you all my candy. I give you all my alcohol, all my drugs. You know, I wanted you to like me. I wanted to be accepted, any means necessary. You know, so I grew up very hurt. I grew up very scarred. I grew up very isolated. You know, I had all the symptoms of the disease of addiction. As life went on, 17, 18, you know, I continued to use, I continued to drink, you know. By then, I'm thinking I'm grown, and, you know, I'm doing grown things, and, you know, a little boy doing grown things, you know. By that time, you know, I'm not paying attention to what's going to happen. What do I need to do at 21, you know? And Dad was like, you know, look, you almost 21, you need to do something, you know. You got to go somewhere, do something. You know, and he never said get out or anything like that. He was like, do something, you know. And I was like, you know, I was working, but, you know, do something, though, you know, because all I was doing was working and partying, whatever. So I decided to come to Atlanta, you know, and, you know, all those issues that I left at home, that I had at home, they came with me here, you know. And you know, the alcohol was still good. The alcohol actually numbed me from all that stuff, you know. And no, when I was young, I had a secret. You know, I had this secret that I, since I was a child, I had this secret that I couldn't tell anybody. And my family was, you know, by that time, you know, me and my sister, my dad, my brother, we were very close. But dad was kind of distant. I remember him sleeping with different women, you know, and it was okay. And I remember one moved in with us, and my sister didn't like her very much. So, you know, she didn't stay long. Because, again, I told you my sister was the boss. She controlled everything. You know, and and what I did when I turned, I think I was 20 years old, and I came to Atlanta. I moved to Atlanta. I said, well, Dad, a couple of my friends were here, and I said, well, Dad, I'm going to move to Atlanta. He said, okay. So I came to Atlanta. And really my dreams were, my goals were, I wanted to go to Atlanta Arts Institute. I wanted to be a chef, and I didn't want to cook the chef. I really wanted to decorate cakes. That was my dream. That was my passion. And let me go back just a little bit real quick so you can understand why that was my passion, because at an early age, I was cooking our food. When my dad wasn't there, I was cooking for me, my brother, and my sister. I loved to cook. It was just naturally in me. And I was going to Atlanta Arts Institute, but those were my dreams and my goals. But by the time I got here, you know what was in Atlanta, all the parties and all the cocaine and everything else you wanted, you know? And that it took off. I mean, you know, in addiction is we experiment, then it becomes recreational, then it becomes habitual, then it becomes full-blown. You know, I experimented with it, with all of that, the alcohol and everything, and then it became recreational. But by the time, you know, when I got here, it was already recreational, and by that time, it became habitual. You know, it was like, you know, all those issues that I grew up with and all that sadness because I was no longer around the people that that loved me the most. You know, I was around all these new, different faces, you know, and I was still trying to get accepted in some kind of way. And, I mean, my addiction, I drank and I drank and I drank and I drank. And I worked. I still worked. I worked at, when I first got here, I worked at a place called the Colonnade Restaurant. Anybody been to the Colonnade? And you know what kind of place that is. I mean, it was fun. We made money. And all I know is that, you know, I disappointed them a whole lot. I was a very, very good worker. But the owner of the place loved me. Because I was a good worker, you know. I made his ass money, you know. But he liked me so much. And I would disappoint him. I would, you know, I would get drunk and, you know, get paid and wouldn't show up the next week and the next day and all that kind of, the whole routine. I went through that cycle for years. And finally they just said, you know, dude, you're not going to get it together, you know. And so I left and ventured off and went everywhere else to work, whatever I did and whatever. And you know, eventually my addiction took off to the point where it was so bad, you know, and I went for treatment, like most of us did, you know. And they suggested that I stay in treatment for 30 days. And if you look up the word suggestion, it means a subtle command. So when you say suggest, you know, it was like, okay, he's just suggesting it, so I don't really have to do it, you know. But, you know, previously, I had to look that word up. It means a subtle command. It means you need to do that, you know. So when your sponsor is giving you suggestions, it's like, you know, don't take it so lightly, you know. So, you know, I went to treatment, 28-day program, whatever. You know. The food was good. The bed was warm. It was warm in there. I met a lot of good people, you know. And that's when they was giving you Anabuse. So, you know, and I went straight out and drank with the Anabuse. So, you know, I got sick and all that, you know, did all what I did. So, and then I just didn't get it. I wasn't getting it. I wasn't hearing it. I just wanted to stop for a moment because I wanted to go back to work. You know, I love my job, whatever. So, you know, I went out and got some more pain and I did it again. You know, I went to treatment again. The second treatment place that I went to, it was very warm. It was over on going back, Grady Holmes. I don't know if any of y'all know, but y'all might know. It was called Wim Home Boards. All the windows were broke out. Whatever. And I said, oh my God, I'm not going to stay in this place. But downstairs, it was so warm in there. And everybody was so nice. And I got this feeling like they wanted me there. And I was like, really? You know, and the director was like, you know, have a seat. Do you really want to be here and all that and all that? You know, and I was like, yes, I really want to be here. I'm in a lot of pain, you know. And I didn't know how to say I was in a lot of pain. I just knew to say that, you know, yeah, I want to do something about my problem. You know, I wanted some help. And I did. I stayed for 6 months. Oh, and I got a new job. You know, when we get them 90-day wonders in 5 months, and I got a new job, and I was making all this money, and, you know, this good money. And so every other Saturday, you had to be there for a community meeting. And I told them I needed to make money this Saturday. I'm not going to be able to be at this community meeting. And the director told me, well, if you're not going to be at this Saturday, you need to pack your things and get out. I said, how dare he? You know? And I packed my things and I got out. And I was fucked up, excuse me, that night. So that was the first time, you know, my experience. And, you know, I was not a one-day white chipper come in here and get it all together, you know. And then the second time, I did it again. I think I went to St. Jude's. And I didn't stay. No, I went to Borders again. They let me back in. Tried it again, and I got a whole year sober. Got a whole year. And my dad came here for my celebration and all that, and I think a week after, I used again. I was like, I'm constitutionally incapable. Something's wrong with me. I went in a real deep depression, you know, and I went on a run so bad, I was just like, you know, this is not for me, you know. And there were some people that I got sober with for that year, and they were still there. And I was like, this is not for me. This is not going to God. I was angry with God. I was angry at God because I was like, why are you taking me through all this? Why do I have to keep going through this? You know, and if something was wrong with me. And it was really that I didn't want to give myself to this simple program. You know, I didn't want to get a hand surrendered, you know. Something happened this last time, 2001, March the 2nd. I don't know what it was, you know, but it had nothing to do with, you know, that I didn't have a place to stay. It had nothing to do with that I didn't have a job, no money. It had nothing to do with any of that. I didn't care. This time I was so empty inside. It was unexplainable. I can't even explain it to you guys tonight. I was just empty. I had never been that empty in my life, you know. And when you get to that emptiness, you need to feel it. So when I felt it, I went forward. And some friends, they were sober, and they told me to come to their house for the weekend. And I did, and I slept the whole weekend. They woke me up. One of them was celebrating that night. They woke me up that Saturday. It was that Friday. Slept all day Friday. They woke me up that Saturday afternoon to go to the celebration. And I went to the celebration. And I picked up a white chip. I didn't know if I was finished. I didn't know nothing. I was out of it. I was like, whatever. After the celebration, they took me back to the house. And I slept till Sunday. I slept all day Sunday. And I woke up Monday morning. And I went back to treatment. And when I went to treatment this time, they didn't have to tell me anything. They didn't have to tell me. All they needed to do was show me where my groups were, what time I needed to be there, give me a sheet, and that's what I did. And I'm talking about following some directions, you know. And what I did was I stayed 4 months, you know. And after 4 months, you know, I didn't get cocky. I didn't get big-headed. I just listened. But I was tired of treatment. I was tired of treatment centers. I was so sick of treatment centers, I didn't know what to do. But really, I had a slight bit of confidence in myself this time that I had never had before, that I didn't want to drink anymore. And that confidence came out like in a way is what I did everything they told me to do. When they wasn't looking, I went to meetings. When they told me to be honest, I was honest. I wasn't dishonest. When they told me to do this, I was on time. I did what I was supposed to do. You know, so I felt a bit of confidence in myself that I was going to do this. You know, I wanted this this time. That's what it was. And of course, I went on and I did. And I left in 4 months. Me and a guy was in detox, and we roommated, and we stayed roommates for 10 years. And that was another story. But, you know, now I'm going to tell you that now I was sober, and I did everything I was supposed to do there. And when I left, I still did everything, most of the stuff that I was supposed to do. Now, some other stuff creeped up. The disease came back, I guess, you know. And it started telling me stuff. It started telling me that I was lonely. It started telling me I need some sex. You know what I'm saying? It started telling me when I got my first car, you need to ride over here. You need to do this, you know. And I have to tell my story the way it is. And you guys have the right to judge me. I'm giving you the right. It's okay. It's okay. My story is my story. And what I owe AA is to tell the truth and to be honest. You know, that's what I owe AA. I don't care if you come in here and you try to tell someone else's story, you're not going to stay sober. You need to tell your own story. You need to tell your own truth. You know, and that's what's been keeping me sober for this long, is that I've gotten sold to the gut level honesty. I never knew I could get that honest, you know. And I've done some stuff sober that I didn't think I could get through clean. So I'm going through 1 through 7, and it's a smooth breeze, and I'm enjoying myself. I'm going on vacations. I went to Hawaii to the North Carolina World Convention, and I went to the Virgin Islands. You know, I never done, drunk like me, I've never done nothing like that. You know what I mean? So I'm just enjoying life, and life is getting better and better materialistically, you know. And now, other stuff started creeping in, but 8 years hit, and the man that raised me died. My dad died when I had 8 years, and it devastated me. And it didn't hit me while I was here because by the way, I'm from Louisville, Kentucky. Anybody here from Kentucky? No. I am. You are. I'm from Louisville. So I got the call, and I had to work that day. And I got the call, and they said he had died. I was at Target, and I was in the parking lot. I was getting ready to leave or something. And I just stopped the car, and it was just like I was numb. And, you know, but the best thing was I didn't want to drink. I did not want to drink, and I was so grateful for that, but I didn't pay attention that I didn't want to drink. I was just, you know, focusing on the numbness and, oh, my God, Dad just died, you know. And that's the man that when all the times that I went to jail drunk, he sent money here to get me out. All the times that I called and said I didn't have any money, I needed this and I needed that, you know, y'all know the story. Bail me out, you know, on whatever terms. He died. It really didn't hit me until I got there the next day. Well, and 2 days later at the wake, that's when it really got me. When I saw him in that casket, that's when I just broke down and I couldn't take it. Now, after that, and I got all of that out of me, you know, during the funeral, I was okay. But I miss him. I miss him so much. Because, you know, when you have someone that just believes in you no matter what, when you had someone, you know, I mean, you still, and I search for that now sometimes. And I got some people that are very close to me. My small sister's here tonight. I feel so much better. And I got some people that are very close to me and they believe in me. You know, I'm talking about that parent love, that dad love that he believed that I could do, you know what I'm saying? And that before he died, about 4 years before he died, 5 years before he died, me and him got so close. We got really, really close. And how I knew we got close, because we started talking about cooking. My dad cooked too. He loved to cook. And we started, every Sunday, we would get on the phone and we would talk for hours about cooking and what we were going to do. And when he died, I went home, when I went home for the funeral, and we handled all his affairs. I had never done that before, you know, and it was a sign of I'm growing up, you know. Again, my sister wanted to control everything, and she had to do it this daggone way and this way, and you know, and that became another story, you know. But we're still close today, and my little brother was his baby. He's very successful, and for a long time when I was using, I was kind of envied my little brother because he was so successful, you know. He was so successful, and I felt like a loser. I felt like I was, you know, what's wrong with me? And again, I was angry with God, you know. And it, you know, life went on, and you know, I came back, and I kept working, and you know, I had 9.5 years, and I no joke, I was at the Colonnade restaurant from when I had 6 months to 9.5 years. That's a long time at a job for a drunk like me, you know. Till one day she fired me. Oh my God, I had 9.5 years, and she fired me. I was super waiter. How could you fire me? You know, not even super waiter. I was the best one in there. So that's what my ego told me. That's what my disease told me. And I knew I was good now. I'm not saying that. My attitude sucked. And really, my attitude sucked. You know, you could not step on my toes. You know, you need to get out of my way. Don't you know I need to make my bill money? You know, excuse me. I'm here, you know. And that's the way it, you know, pretty much, because I thought I had been there so long, and I never had been on a job that long. And I never had done that good, so I, you know what I'm saying? And I thought I was, you know, the one, the super one. And I thought I could talk to people and give my opinion how I wanted to, you know. And what I didn't know about recovery was that, you know, you need to be mannerable. You need to speak better. You need to... You need to learn how to address people, period. You know, and it's the solution is a way to say things, you know. And I didn't know any better. I'm yelling at people, you know, you need to do this, you know, yeah, all that craziness, you know. And she fired me one night. And, oh, my God. I said, oh, my, what am I going to do? You know, I got a car payment. I've got a rent. I've got this. I got that. And I want to do this, and I want to do that. And, you know, all I could do was lay in the bed with my head over my covers for, I think, 2 days. And what happened was, two of my customers, I had a lot of call parties, a lot of regular customers in there. One of my call parties, they came to my house, and they said they could not believe that she fired me. And they wrote me a check. And I was, like, all out of it, like I had been doing drugs or something. I was like, no, I lost my... You know, I lost something, a part of me. You know, I like, what am I going to do? You know, I had never been on unemployment. You know, I had never had to look for a job since I've been sober. You know, I had a job, you know. So what am I going to do? And I looked at the check. I saw a five. I thought it was $500. But it was $1,500. And I'd be like, yes, oh, my God. I said, at least that's, you know, I could pay my car note. I could do this. I've said I'm good. And really, I didn't have that much savings. I maybe had, you know, $400 or $500 on my savings, and that's not good, whatever, whatever. You know, I told you I was a materialistic guy, right? Okay. So life went on. So at part-time I was working for one of my customers, an elderly guy, and I was working for him. I was just running and getting food. He had retired, and I was running and getting food, picking up his prescriptions and stuff. He was paying me like $200 a week, something like that. After I lost my job, he asked me to work for him full time. This guy paid me more money than I ever made in my life. And I was like, when I saw what he told me what he was going to pay, I said, oh my God, you know, here we go. Back in addiction. Back with the same ego that I left the Colonnade. I went right back. You know, and that's why I say we suffer from something that's just insane in my thinking. You know, I'm you know, why would I go back to that same frame of thinking and acting the same way? You know, and you know, I had to take him to dinner every night, and you know, it was kind of, you know, it got really graphic. You know, when I say graphic, it got really graphic. From a 73-year-old man, I had to wipe him and clean him, and you know, he would just shit on the floor. And I'd be like, you know, oh my God, you know, I'm a waiter. I never took care of no elderly person. I'm like, this is not my field. And the sponsor was telling me, maybe you need to go in that field. I said, no, I don't, you know. I don't. Do you know how bad that smells? Do you? Oh, my God. How that looks. And as you know, you know, he had an agency come in there first. And then when he asked me to do it full time, first thing he asked me to, can I start bathing? I was like, oh, God. And he said, it's going to be more money, whatever. And I was thinking about the money. You know I was. I'm a materialistic guy now, you know. I'm thinking, oh, my God, this check's going to be so big. I can do this and I can do that, you know. And I did. I started bathing him, and it was horrible. It was horrible. It was horrible. But as I kept doing it, I started a love grew on me for him. He started loving me unconditionally, and I started loving him unconditionally. We were best friends, and he was a big. He was so not okay with how he had become. He was getting old, and he was, you know, nothing was, you know, becoming. He knew he was going to die. He hadn't died yet, but and that's what he thought. He didn't want to see anybody, none of his friends and nothing. It was only me. And I was like, I'm the only one there. And after a while, you know, the checks were good. I'm telling you, they were good. They were fucking good. Fucking good. You know, I couldn't get over it. I was like, wow. You know, and I'm doing this. Yeah, man, this is cool. You know, but after a while, it got overwhelming because, you know, I would leave. And we thought he was suffering from dementia. I would leave and he would call me 5 minutes. Can you come right back? And I'd be like, dude, you know, well, can you come over here? Because this is happening and this happening. And it's like, oh, my God, he started taking over my whole life. And I started sharing about it. And it was like, some people was like, well, hell, ain't you getting a check? I was like, yeah, but, you know, I don't have no life. I was working for 7 days a week. I had to get up at 9 o'clock, having breakfast there. 5 o'clock every day. He didn't want to eat dinner at 5:05. He wanted to eat dinner at 5 o'clock. And we went to all his favorite restaurants around in Buckhead, whatever. You know, and it was a good thing. You know, because I got to eat free, you know, every day. And the thing about it, what really kicked in my recovery was, you know, his checkbook laid right here. And his power of attorney watched all his books and stuff. But, I mean, this man was rich. He wasn't just had money, okay? He was rich. You know, I saw a couple of the counts because of the paperwork that came through and we had to do whatever. And he was rich. And his power of attorney had explained, he knew me very well as well, and told me he was very wealthy and da, da, da. Surprisingly, I never took anything from him. I was too scared. My integrity was too high. I had gotten too much. I had came from losing my job to this right here. I couldn't take anything. And not to say, when in my addiction now, I stole a couple of things. I was too scared to rob anybody, anything. I was such a punk. I wasn't going to nobody's prison. I went to jail a couple of times for, you know, DUI. No, not DUIs, but drunkenness and all that. But I never went to prison. I never got a felony. And that's not to say that anybody that has that, we all recover. You can recover. But I'm saying that I was such a punk that I was so scared. But he gave me everything in a sense where he wrote me nice checks and, you know, he was very fair to me. A few times he gave me $5,000 bonuses. I was like, oh my God, you know, and it was really good, you know. But I worked for it and I earned it. You know, cleaning up somebody is a lot of work. I don't know if y'all know that. To wipe somebody's behind was a lot of, it was mental. I'm serious. And I'm not being funny. This is my story. You know, so, I'm going to go back just a little bit and where my, you know, where some of my confusion came in at, and where my inadequacy, where my need for love and acceptance comes from. You know, I told you I had a secret, and I could not tell anybody what this secret was. I lived with this secret for a long, 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 long time. You know,
And, you know, I go to some groups and, you know, you get comfortable in some groups and you tell your story or whatever, whatever, and people know you and they get used to your story. You know, they got to get used to you. They know you, you know. And when you go somewhere else and you go into a whole room and all y'all white, I'm sorry. and to, when I first got out, I was like, they're not going to understand this. You know, it really doesn't matter, you know. What matters is that, you know, today I'm learning to love myself. Today I'm learning, I have embraced and accepted me for who and whatever I am, meaning that I'm an alcoholic today, you know, and I embrace that. When I say I embrace that, that means, you know, if I got to do this for the rest of my life, not if I got to, I'm doing this for the rest of my life, meaning that when I'm tired, I go to meetings. When I'm tired, I do this. When I'm tired, I do this for Alcoholics Anonymous in this program. And, you know, my life is built in the middle of this program, you know. And I'm like, wow, you know, I never thought in a million years that I would have 13 years of sobriety. I never, ever thought that, you know, because I was a drunk that got, I got drunk for 25 years. You know, again, I'm 47. I look good, don't I? In 25 years, man, you know, 25 years, my life was crap. My life was crap. I couldn't make a solid decision, a well decision on a consistent basis, you know. But what scared me, what frightened me so much, you know, about this secret that I had, and I never could tell nobody. I could never tell my family members. When I came around y'all, you know, y'all look like my family. You know what I mean? Y'all look like them because I thought y'all was going to judge me. That's why I told you in the beginning, I said, you guys have the right to judge me. That's okay. You know, I'm not going to sit around a program that I got to live in the rest of my life and have any secrets. That's why I used in the first place, you know, because I couldn't embrace and accept who I really was. Number one was I was an addict and an alcoholic. If I can't embrace that and love that, I'm taking a risk of using. I think in the 12 and 12 it talks about it. Precarious. Is it precarious? What does it say? Is that the word? Precarious, right? It means risky, right? Huh? Yeah. I read that. I could not tell my family that I was gay. I never could tell that. Especially my dad. My dad loved women. He loved women. My cousins, they loved women. Could you imagine growing up around some big basketball players, black dudes, and talking about, boy, you better get you some. They made me do what I want. You know what I mean? And I had this secret that I could not tell them. So what it did was it led me deeper and deeper into the bottle because I couldn't tell nobody that secret. I'm talking about sweating under my arms, in my hand, palm of my hands, everything sweating if they were to find out. I'm talking about it. I didn't, you know, I was never molested or anything like that. I knew who I was. I knew who I was at a very early age. Not fully. Now, I didn't say I accepted it. I mean, I cried a lot of nights and a lot of days and asked God. I was angry with God. And I asked him, why you made me like this? Why? Why am I different? I felt different all my life. And I couldn't understand it. And I cried. And I isolated. I drank. I used. I went over here for love and acceptance. I went over there for love and acceptance. You know. And really, it doesn't appear that I am, because you guys would never know if I didn't tell you, right? So that was the confusion right there. That was everywhere I went, people didn't know. So it created more problems. It created more problems than I ever wanted to have in this sexuality. So it made me real hard to even live in this sexuality. You know, I knew I wasn't this and I knew I wasn't that. So then when I, you know, face to face with somebody, they didn't know. And then I got to tell them. You know, every job that I started, people didn't know. You know, you work somewhere for a lot of years or you go, you know, you roommate with somebody, they're going to find out eventually. And I'm saying these secrets, all this stuff was killing me, man. All this hiding, it was killing me. And the only thing I could do to escape was made me feel better was drugs, alcohol, something. I had to have something different. So, you know, this is my story, you know. And the reason, you know, it was good that I finally started embracing it, you know. I think I would have died had I kept hiding, had I been scared and full of fear of death, you know. And I'm here to tell you, I never told my dad. I never told him. He died. I wanted to so bad, I just couldn't bring it to myself. But the conversations that we had years before he died, he knew. He knew. He kind of let me know he knew. Not right out. But I kind of got some closure, you know. A few months before he died, you know, we talked and he told me he loved me. Because he was one of the, he was the first one on my resentment list in my fourth step. He called me a sissy one time. And do you know, that lived with me all my life. I'm talking about one, I'm talking about from him. That was the person that was my hero. That was the one that raised me. That was the one that had my heart. You know, that was the first man that I ever knew. And he called me a sissy because I couldn't pick up that air conditioner. He told me, pick that thing up. I couldn't pick that thing up. You know, but I'm telling you, that scarred me for my life. It scarred me for life. You know, he was the first one on my resentment list. And anybody, you know, all this came from my family. And I had my older cousins, and they called me a sissy. You could call me one today, and, you know, whatever. I'd be okay with it. But when I first got here, if you called me out of my name like that, it would take me all the way back to when my dad called me. In my mind. You know, that resentment is just reliving the past. You know, it takes me all the way back until I started embracing and started loving me of who I am. And I ran around trying to have sex with everything. Oh my God, you know, trying to find acceptance and love in every way I could, I'm telling you, you know. And I'm really, really, you know, finally touching on some things that needs to, you know, it needs to stop. It needs to stop. You know, when I first got here, you know, I didn't stop the lifestyle a little bit, meaning that, you know, I still clubbed a little bit. And I'm not telling anyone to do that. I'm just saying what I did. And it was very unhealthy. It was very unhealthy. But what I did, I stayed grounded in the program. I stayed around people that were recovering. I constantly stayed on the phone. Because I was scared I was going to drink, too, you know. So I encourage anybody new. Now, I don't know what this new thing is coming up. This new Jack, you know, you guys, newcomers, they're doing a lot of different stuff out there today, you know, that. You know, it's more than drinking, whatever. You know, I did more than drinking, too. You know. I encourage you guys to get with each other and help each other, you know, as much as you can. You know. I don't know. You know, I'm grateful that... I don't want to cry, but I'm feeling like I'm ready to cry. And in the last couple of weeks, because I'm ready to come up on an anniversary... I was crying inside. I was at work and I was just crying inside. I was so sad and I don't even know why I was sad. And I don't think I was sad. I think I just get to a point sometimes when you be like, you go to different levels in your recovery and you feel something. And it's like God is getting ready to take these old limbs off and let the new ones grow. And I don't want the new ones to grow yet. I'm trying to be so stubborn. and I don't want to surrender, and the new ones are getting ready to grow, and I don't want them to grow, man, because I want to stay the damn same. I don't want to change, you know? So you're going to go through different phases and different levels in your recovery, you know? All I know is that, you know, I'm not trying to be like I used to be. I'm not trying to do those same things, you know. And you know, like I said, you have the right to judge me. And I know some newcomers in here. They can't understand, you know. But don't let your secrets keep you using. Don't let it keep you using, whatever it is, you know. Because you're going to hear a lot of stuff in this program. I hear some different stuff, a lot of stuff, and then some old timers in here that know that, you know. But it's important to continue to be honest with yourself and know what's hurting you, and talk about what's hurting you, and stop feeling unimportant. For a long time, I felt unimportant in here, like my story didn't matter. Nobody wants to hear that stuff. You know what I mean? Like I started to change my mind when I was sitting there. I said, I'm not ready to tell these folks this, all this stuff. They don't understand this, you know. And that's crap. That's crap. You know, I owe this to AA to be truthful and to be honest, you know. I didn't know it was going to be this many people. You know, Eric said something. I want to thank Eric and Christian, his wife, his lovely wife, for inviting me. And Eric is my boss. I don't know I guess the home group knows Eric. Eric's my boss. He's a heck of a caterer. We work good together. I'm learning a lot of stuff, you know. I just wish he'd push me on out there and let me do a little more. but he's very particular, and he's very good. And I've learned to like him. Not only that, I've learned to love him. Yeah, because Eric's a very particular guy, man. You have to, you know. You know what I mean? food is my passion, man. It's my passion. And I suggest that the newcomers, find your dream. Find your dream and what you really want to do. And find it, and it'll bring out the best out of you. It'll bring the best out of you. You will want to stay sober chasing your dreams and your goals. You will want to stay sober chasing your dreams and your goals. If you don't have any, you know, it's going to make it kind of difficult. It's going to make it like, oh, being sober is boring, you know what I mean? Because when I first got sober, shit was boring. You know what I'm saying? I had to spice it up a little bit. You know. Huh? I had to spice it up a little bit, you know. And they told me wear this daggone suit jacket. I'm going to take this shit off. And I guess what I mean is that, you know, I came in here this little bitty boy at 35 years old. You know, I got sober. Little bitty boy. Mentality, emotionally, just a little boy. You know, you could step on my toes and I just hurt my feelings. You know, and I appeared to be tough. You know, I was shaky and insecure on the inside, you know. But I gave you this, my little bitty, but I gave you this exterior like I was the tough guy, you know. I had a mouthpiece on me to make you think I could fight a wolf. And I wasn't going to bust a grape. You know what I mean? For real. I wasn't getting ready to do nothing, you know. But I had an exterior mouth that think you, you know, and that there was a defect that protected me when I was out there. And I brought it in here with me because all of y'all looked like my cousins and my family. Y'all was going to judge me. Y'all was going to hurt me. And y'all was going to call me a sissy. And God, if you ever called me a sissy, you know, that was just, you were cut off, you know. So today, I'm practicing, you know, I don't have to always be understood. I don't have to always run my mouth. Maybe if you just shut up, Daryl, be quiet, you know, do your step work, clean your side of the street up, you know, and get yourself together, continue to work your steps and work your spiritual principles instead of trying to tell everybody else what to do, you know. The first time I was in treatment, they made me the house man. when I had that year. They made me the house man. So I walked around telling everybody else, you need to do this, you need to do this. And they stayed clean. I went back out and drank, you know, telling somebody else what they needed to do, you know, and not practicing anything that needed to be practiced. What time is it? My wife says, I think I'm... Is it 25? It's over, right? Is it? Thank God. Thank y'all.
Thanks for listening. I hope you enjoyed the podcast. Sobercast is ad-free, and we'd like your help in order to keep it that way. So if you'd like to help us be self-supporting by pledging $1 or $2 a month, visit Sobercast.com and look for the donate links. Thank you very much.